This is Aspire, Arch Street Public Radio, a content-driven platform broadcasting interviews from our Innovate, Innovate Media, Innovate CSR, and Innovate Under 30 podcast series. Aspire gives public voice to socially conscious and forward-thinking leaders within the nonprofit and for-profit sectors, academia, journalism, and social entrepreneurship.
My name is Robert Rim, Managing Editor for Arch Street Press. I'll be your host today. Today our guest is Dr. James Downing, President and CEO of St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, a nonprofit medical corporation committed to advancing cures and means of prevention for pediatric catastrophic diseases through research and treatment. St. Jude was founded by entertainer Danny Thomas in 1962 with a vision that no child be denied treatment based on race, religion, or a family's ability to pay. Dr. Downing, a Detroit native, earned his undergraduate and medical degrees at the University of Michigan. After training in anatomic pathology at Washington University in St. Louis and completing a fellowship in hematopathology at the University of Florida in Gainesville, Dr. Downing joined St. Jude in 1986. He became scientific director and executive vice president in 2004 and deputy director in 2011. He was named the hospital's sixth CEO in 2014. Dr. Downing was a key figure in launching the Pediatric Cancer Genome Project, which made Time Magazine's 2012 list of top 10 medical breakthroughs. He's been awarded many honors, and in 2013, Dr. Downing was elected to the Institute of Medicine, a branch of the National Academy of Sciences. James, great to have you with us today.
Well, thank you, Robert. Glad to be here.
How did you discover your interest in medical science?
You know, I was an undergraduate, actually in engineering school, and very proficient at math. And I vividly remember a class where the professor was graphing the cost of recalling a product versus the cost of just leaving it out there and handling the lawsuits that would result from the defective product. And stopped and thought to myself, I'm not sure this is what I want to do. And so it was really at that point I took a biology class and just fell in love with it, switched my major to biochemistry, and sort of moved my way through research into medicine and then into where I am today. So it was really that realization that I love math, but I really wanted to do something that I was passionate about and something that I would excite me every day. And that first biology class in college really opened my eyes to a world that has been my passion, since then. Mm-hmm.
And obviously you've been with St. Jude for a long time. Did you decide early on that you wanted to play a role in the nonprofit sector?
No, I going through medicine and going through your fellowship training, I knew I wanted to do research. I was a hematopathologist and knew I wanted to work in blood disorders and, really thought I was going to focus in leukemia. I had never given any thought to whether that would be adult leukemia or pediatric leukemia and, had always been part of large academic medical centers. But literally one day I got a call from somebody who sort of told me his name. He says, "You don't know who I am, but I have the perfect job for you." And it was a call from St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. And I came down and interviewed, and literally during that interview process sort of fell in love with the, what St. Jude is, this nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing cures for pediatric catastrophic diseases. And so I moved my wife and my two young children at that time to Memphis, Tennessee, and started this journey that's taken me over the last 30 years.
And you're a leader in pediatric cancer research with a focus on understanding the genetic basis of cancer, specifically to improve the treatment of children. So what inspired your dedication to studying cancer? Was it just part of the research aspect, or were there people in your family who?
No, it really was the research aspect. I mean, I started working in laboratory science, sort of through my clinical training, focused more on leukemia. But it was really the excitement of asking questions about what drives cancer, what are the underlying genetic lesions, how do those alterations actually you know, cause a cell to become a cancer cell. And, you know, I found myself literally thinking about it all the time. I'd wake up in the morning and, you know, I had had dreams about how to pursue a particular question or what the results I had seen the day before meant. And it was really that intellectual curiosity that drove me. You know, I knew the consequences these diseases had to the children that were treated at St. Jude. And, you know, that became a reality of it, that there was meaning behind what we were doing and that we needed to advance cures because these children were dying. But it was also, you know, that, well, here's the question, here's the experiment, and then seeing the results and the excitement of actually seeing those results and knowing, hey, we've made an advancement. Now, what's the next step? How do we get this into the clinic? How do we advance this so that we can improve on the cure rates for the children?
Yeah, and these are quite some journeys, aren't they?
They are. They, you know, they go from wild success to long periods of failure. You know, they're driven by technology and by changes in technology over time, and they're slow. You know, one would like to see home runs all the time, but in the world of science, they're not home runs. They're constant hits to try to advance the game and to try to make progress. And you know, as I reflect back on 30 years, you know, some people complain about the progress that's been made on cancer, but it's really quite amazing the progress that's been made in those 30 years, not only for pediatric cancer, but also for many of the adult cancers.
Yeah, and, you know, these days we can't imagine what life in the world is like without cell phones. And so perhaps in a generation, you know, we'll say the same question. We can't imagine, you know, what it's like to have, you know, cancer. Who knows what's going to be around the corner?
You know, I remember when I first, you know, started working at St. Jude, and we were, you know, exploring certain oncogenes that drove cancer. And I remember at that time doing DNA sequencing was very hard. We used to have to pour large gels and use radioactive isotopes, and it would be a 3 or 4 day process just to get a couple hundred base pairs of sequence and laborious reading the sequence. And, you know, we could only advance the questions we were pursuing with the available technology. But now we look back, you know, 25 years later with the completion of the human genome, with the advent of next generation sequencing machines, and, you know, the Pediatric Cancer Genome Project that we started in 2010. When I started here, it was something we would have never even dreamed of. In 2010, we were able to dream that and say, let's do it. Let's use this next generation sequencing and look at the landscape of mutations that underlie pediatric cancer. And we, you know, we didn't know if we could be successful. We didn't know what we would find. But, you know, it literally has transformed our understanding of pediatric cancer. And I think as we look to the future, there will be new technologies, you know, new methodologies that will become available that will build on that information and give us even more insight and better ways of treating children with cancer. So which it is exciting.
Yeah, and which is really inevitable given the spread of technology and how it's progressing, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, the convergence, right, of computer science, of mathematics, of computational biology, computational chemistry, you know, with fundamental biology and advances in microscopy. It really, you know, medical imaging, new ways of treating. It is amazing, you know, the rate of progress and, you know, how we can cure more and more people with cancer with less and less toxicity.
And how did you discover your interest in helping children? Were your own kids a part of that process?
You know, in a subtle way, I think. So I had three kids, and you know, when I was first came to St. Jude, I think every single cold my children had, I thought it was cancer. You know, so upset, and we got to get them to the doctor. You know, and you watch your own children grow up. You watch the kids here at St. Jude. You watch some of them not make it. You know, and it really, you know, became a lifelong commitment. I think it built in me slowly, but it really became, you know, especially as the leader of St. Jude, well, this is our responsibility. It is St. Jude's responsibility to see how it can catalyze and advance the field for treating children with catastrophic diseases, primarily cancer. And so it became a sort of a commitment. We need to do what others can't do to advance the cure rates for children with cancer. And, you know, now I think it's a driving motivation. I spend a little less time in the laboratory looking at data. My responsibilities really are towards the institution now. And, you know, I think as an institution, it's all about the kids. I think for every single employee or 4,200 employees, you know, it's what about the kids? You know, the kids that are here, the kids that aren't treated at St. Jude, the kids around the globe that have cancer, what can we do to help them?
That's so good to hear, and obviously provides hope to so many families who otherwise wouldn't have access. You assisted with the launching of the Pediatric Cancer Genome Project, which produced really groundbreaking discoveries for four different types of brain tumors, subtypes of child leukemia, cancer of the peripheral nervous system, an eye tumor, and Lou Gehrig's disease. How were you involved in that?
Well, you know, so I led the project. And, you know, I remember when we first sort of thought of the project. So I had done a lot of work in genomics on leukemia, sort of low resolution genomics. My lab had been interested in that for a number of years. There were other labs that were doing, similar kind of work on brain tumors and solid tumors. And I knew that the big efforts, the federally funded efforts, both in the United States and around the globe, were really focused on adult cancer. And so, you know, one day we got around and said, why don't we do it? Why doesn't St. Jude just stand up and fund a pediatric cancer genome project? And so I literally set up a retreat of all of our faculty. About 85% of our faculty went to this retreat. It was offsite, and we had really deep discussions on what would a project look like, why should we do it, what's the uncertainty within a project like this, how might the money be spent some alternative way. We actually had faculty assigned to be against the project and faculty to be for the project. So over a day and a half, we went through this. And at the end of it, the faculty just overwhelmingly supported the project. One of the most senior people in the institution who had nothing to do with pediatric cancer stood up and he said, this is St. Jude. This is what we have to do. So then it became, how do we actually set up this project? And so I put together a steering committee, led that steering committee. We sought out the right partner, Washington University, their genome center. And then we organized the project. And, you know, I probably spent 50% of my time leading the project over the 3 years of the initial project, with operational meetings, data management meetings, you know, selection meetings of what tumors we were going to sequence, looking at all the data with everybody. We met every other week. Literally every week with one group or another, you know, several meetings a week with some of the operational groups working through this. And it was probably the most amazing experience I had in my entire career, because it was the first time I saw it bringing together people with just incredibly diverse backgrounds, from computational biologists to surgeons to chemical biologists to leukemia docs and brain tumor docs and solid tumor docs. And all of us would get in the room every other week. And the interactions and the support and the insights from that group really is what drove the project. So, you know, it's like nothing I'd ever been in before. And it really, I think in many respects, galvanized much of the institution, and much of the work that we do today is driven off the insights that came out of that project.
And that connection that you made with so many diverse types of people, that camaraderie, was that primarily because of the overriding vision and literally helping children? Or is there something that you could transfer from that experience that could be applied to other fields beyond medicine?
Yeah, I think it was, I think it is beyond medicine. I think it is the idea of getting very diverse people who never interact. You know, the brain tumor docs seeing the brain tumor patients, the leukemia docs see the children with leukemia, and the chemical biologists are off on their own, and the computational biologists aren't sure what the clinical problems are. And it was really bringing that diverse group together. It was managing that diverse group to make sure that the level of conversation was accessible to everybody in the room, that everybody was respecting each other and seeking potential insights that might come from people who aren't typically thinking about the problem. And it was, I think, a lot of it was developing the relationships from constantly meeting with those individuals and, you know, recognizing that if we make decisions, they have to be supported by all of us on the steering committee. And so working through that, because there are times when, you know, people aren't all on the same page, but how do you get everybody on the same page? How do you make a decision and then tell those that were against it, we heard your views, but we're moving forward? I think over time, everybody really, I think, gained from the experience, not only for the Genome Project, but actually is the way they approach their work going forward.
And as a boy, I remember seeing Danny Thomas so often, and obviously St. Jude remains faithful to the vision of literally its founder, who was Danny Thomas. So beyond a commitment to finding cures and saving children, it's also just wonderful to recognize that families aren't charged for treatment. They're not charged for travel, for housing, for food, letting them really focus only on their children. So how does this model work?
Well, the model is very unique, and it is, in many respects, the way medicine should be practiced. We're lucky because Danny Thomas was a very smart man. And when he set up the organization, he set up two separate corporations. He set up St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, and then he set up a fundraising organization, the American Lebanese Syrian Associated Charities, ALSAC. And the sole purpose of ALSAC was to raise money that would only be spent by St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. And he also set up ALSAC as what he wanted that to be, was to be an organization where the American, Lebanese, and Syrian individuals would pay back the United States for the opportunities that they've received being in the United States. And so this organization now is the largest fundraising organization in the United States, largest healthcare related charity in the United States. It has millions of donors across the United States and raises money that we spend at St. Jude, with a significant proportion of that going to cover the medical costs for the treatment of children, and a significant proportion going to cover the research to advance those cures. It's a model that really allows us to focus on problems that other organizations can't focus on. And so when I took over as CEO, you know, one of the first things I asked was, what can St. Jude do that nobody else can do? And it was really put forward by one of our members of our scientific advisory board, who said, if not for St. Jude, who? And so part of my vision was, so what are those issues, those problems, those positions that only St. Jude can address because of the resources it has, because of the 54-year history it has of advancing cures for pediatric catastrophic diseases, and because of the dedicated employees and faculty, the 4,200 people that work at St. Jude. And so the vision is really to focus on those opportunities where we can stand up and we can bring the entire field of pediatric physicians and researchers together from across the globe and attack the problems that really need to be tackled. One fact is that in the United States, because of work at St. Jude and many other places, the cure rates for pediatric cancer now are slightly above 80%. For acute lymphoblastic leukemia, the most common malignancy seen in the pediatric population, it's greater than 94%.
Which is extraordinary.
It is, but if you think about that 80% for kids with cancer, that still means 1 in 5 dies.
Yeah.
1 in 5 children that walk through our door still dies of their cancer. In fact, cancer remains the leading cause of death due to disease in the United States for children between the age of 1 and 15 years of age. And if you look around the globe, it's not 80%. In fact, There are some that estimate that it might be as low as 20% or even 10% of the children with cancer that actually survive their disease around the world.
Sure.
And so there's a massive problem that we need to address. And St. Jude, that's part of our vision going forward. We want to become the global resource that really catalyzes the field to advance cures for children everywhere in the world and to make sure that children around the globe have access to quality care in the next 50 years.
And given such a huge field and all that you mentioned, and certainly St. Jude treats childhood cancer, many other diseases, including sickle cell, coagulation disorders, bone marrow failure syndrome. So how do you coordinate work on such a wide variety of illnesses?
Well, it's an effort that involves physicians, staff, researchers, nurses, allied health professionals, and we organize them into teams that really focus on particular diseases. And so within cancer, we organize them into the brain tumor group, the solid tumor group, the leukemia group. We have a group that focuses on the long-term outcome of patients. But then we have other groups that are really focused on non-malignant hematologic diseases, one that's focused on sickle cell disease and the issues of treating those patients and managing them into the transition into adult life, a separate group that works on coagulations. And so it's really bringing together the best experts in the world, bringing them to the St. Jude campus, recruiting them here, and then organizing groups around those individuals and the support staff that they assemble to really focus on individual problems and make advances. I think we have a legacy of advances in cancer, but also a strong legacy of advances in non-malignant hematology, from the first transplant to actually cure a child of sickle cell disease, gene therapy trials that are looking incredibly promising for the hemophilias. And then in infectious diseases, you know, we've had a very active HIV program, and one of the founders of that HIV program actually developed the treatment for pneumocystis carinii that actually was killing our leukemia patients. But when HIV first hit, that became the major cause of death for HIV patients. And the treatment we developed for the leukemia patients became the effective treatment for the individuals with HIV. And now that complication we don't see anymore from HIV.
And how does St. Jude's work to balance treatment and research? It seems quite intentional, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. We, we look very carefully at our budget, at our distribution of faculty, at our distribution of space to constantly develop a balance between research, both basic research, translational research, clinical research, and frontline patient care. You know, we sort of look at it that fundamental basic research is the foundation in which all discoveries are really developed. So we have a very strong, basic, fundamental research group. We then have to make sure that the care that we give our patients today is better than anywhere in the world. So we work very hard to make sure that care is fantastic. But then between that basic research and the care, we develop clinical research and we develop translational research, research efforts that bring that basic research into the clinical environment. And it's that interplay between the best care today and the science that is the way we develop tomorrow's best cures.
Yeah.
This Innovate series features dialogue with some of the most influential advocates for changing our world, from the CEOs and founders of major nonprofits to the directors of cultural and academic institutions. Innovate demonstrates the vital role of empathy as an agent for that change. Innovate and Aspire are produced in partnership with Ashoka, Innovators for the Public, the Kellogg Fellows Leadership Alliance, and the Philadelphia Social Innovations Journal, and presented by Arch Street Press and the Public Radio Exchange. We now return to our Innovate interview with Dr. James Downing, President and CEO of St. Jude Children's Research Hospital.
And about research, for our listeners, what's the collaborative research program? How does it work?
Well, You know, it works at many different levels. you know, much of the basic research is working on fundamental problems of why a cell grows, how does it proliferate, how does it develop into normal organs. Cancer and many other diseases are just aberrations of that normal process. From the clinical side, you know, we have investigators that are developing clinical research protocols. They're testing new therapies, but we constantly take the translational group, have them work into the clinical trials, and they work and interact a lot with the basic researchers. So we spend a lot of time thinking of how to mix these elements together, how to make sure that the chance encounters occur much more frequently than one would predict, and to set up really networks of interactions across specific diseases or specific types of approaches, so that there's this intermixing between the clinicians, the translational researchers, and the laboratory basic researchers.
And obviously cancer is such an insidious disease. Can you kind of look ahead and perhaps make an assessment of the progress that St. Jude has made toward literally curing childhood cancer?
Yeah, I think, you know, one would always love to find that magic bullet that would cure every child of cancer, or even bet, you know, could we prevent cancer from ever developing? You know, I think the science and the work to date really tells us that cancer is always going to be with us, that it's always going to be occurring, that there are some patients, almost 10% of the children, that actually have genetic lesions in their normal genes that predispose them to cancer. And so for those patients, we're actually setting up a genetic predisposition clinic where we can follow those patients before their cancer develops and be able to detect the cancer at its earliest possible point and provide more effective therapy where they have a better chance for a cure. For those patients that don't have predisposition, that develop cancer, you know, there's been great advances in understanding the driver lesions and great advances in trying to develop therapies that are targeting those specific lesions. That's available in some cases, not in every case. You know, as we go forward, there's going to be trying to use the patient's own immune system to better tackle the cancer, or genetically manipulate the immune system to be able to use that to treat the cancer. So there really are going to be, you know, continuing evolutions of how best to treat the cancer for individual patients. And so the entire area of precision medicine or personalized medicine, I think, is really the best chance we have for advancing cancer cures and giving every child the best chance for a cure. From the day they walk in, doing whole genome sequencing, whole exome and RNA sequencing on their tumor and on their normal germline, which we're doing now in a new clinical protocol we just opened, interpreting that data, sort of deciding exactly what kind of cancer they have. And from that information and from other information, sort of defining what's the best way to treat this cancer. You know, can we use targeted agents? Do we need to use or stay away from particular drugs? You know, will radiation therapy be valuable? And if so, what kind of radiation therapy? Is it photon-based radiation therapy, or will proton-based radiation therapy be the way to go? And then can cancer immunotherapy actually provide further improvements in the patient's outcome? And can we do all of this and minimize the toxicity so that the child has the best chance for a long and productive life? So I think, you know, we've made great progress. I think there are challenges ahead to try to make sure that we continually improve the cure rates for all the different cancers we see in the pediatric population. And then as we look globally, there are massive challenges. The workforce isn't available. The infrastructure isn't available, you know, in low and middle income countries. And so how do we approach that? How do we train the next generation of sort of scholars that can go out across the globe and actually advance cures for pediatric cancer and other catastrophic diseases around the globe?
And St. Jude is obviously really quite careful about how they treat children beyond the actual medical care. So just what's, for children, from their perspective, what's their time like at the hospital?
You know, it is, it's an amazing environment because, you know, at most children's hospital, when you walk through the halls, you can tell the kids are, you know, afraid, worried, withdrawn, you know, often, you know, apprehensive and not smiling. You know, you come into St. Jude and here, you know, this is, all the kids have serious diseases. All of them are, you know, have the sort of hanging over them, the risk of death. And then you see these kids and they're smiling and they're joyful and they're hopeful. And it is the only place I've ever been where if a child sees his doctor, his or her doctor down the hall, they'll take off running and jump into their arms.
I'm so happy to hear that. Yeah.
Yeah. No, the kids love their doctors and nurses. You know, at the end of chemo for every single child, we throw a big end of chemo party, and you know, all the patients on the floor will come and the families. It's just, you know, usually down in the cafeteria, and it's just a great time. And you know, the kids can be here for 1 to 3 years receiving chemotherapy. Some of them never leave. They live in our housing and come back every other day or every day. Their parents are you know, here taking care of them. But even in our housing facilities, we set them up so that, you know, much of the worries of daily life are taken away from them and they can focus on their children with beautiful play areas and areas where the kids can interact. You know, I want to make sure that the environment for the children and their family is as supportive as it possibly can be. And we get perfect scores in their satisfactions. But every day I want every employee asking, how can we make it better? You know, just as a tiny little thing, the parents are, you know, those parents whose children are here in the hospital, often they're here for several weeks and never get out of the hospital. And, you know, they go back to the cafeteria, back up to the room. And so, you know, and just watching them, it's like, well, they probably need a little exercise room. And so we just built an exercise room in one area of the hospital for the parents, not for anybody else. And, you know, now they can get down there and see it. We give them, you know, breaks where we'll have sessions with them, talk with them, listen to them. You know, we have a family advisory council that weighs in on, you know, the environment of care and how to make the journey that they go through better for them every day.
And empathy obviously plays such a strong role in forming the organization's approach. I would imagine that everybody on staff has a strong element of empathy, don't they?
They do. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a prerequisite to work here. Yeah. I think, you know, one of the most amazing things when you come into this campus, often, you know, visitors, if they're faculty or somebody, they'll get picked up by one of our, one of the employees that drives. We have a large sort of cohort of cars, buses, you know, that drive the patients around, or we'll pick up visitors from the airport. And, you know, usually if you get picked up by one of them, you realize they know everything there is to know about St. Jude, and they know why they're there. They know they're there for the kids. And you get the story from everybody, from the people who clean at night to the people who drive the buses to the people that work in the cafeteria. You know, they all are immensely proud in working here and know that their job matters, that their job makes a difference in how these kids and their families experience the journey that they're going through, and that their job makes a difference in the cure rates.
And they're all part of one body working together.
Yes. And then we actually have one cafeteria. Everybody eats in the same cafeteria. There's no doctor's lounge. The patients and family eat there. Visitors eat there. All the employees. I go down whenever I can. I'll sit with the facilities guys because they know more about what's going on in the hallways than I do. You know, and if one of the kids starts throwing up at the table next to you, you get up and help them. And everybody does that. And, you know, everybody knows from that experience and from watching the families, you know, that's why they're here. I also remember one day walking into the cafeteria not that long ago, probably 6 months ago, and there was somebody wearing a volunteer jacket sort of saying, you know, hello to me. And I was thinking, sort of like a Walmart greeter. Why do we need that? And I couldn't understand why they were there. And then I watched a family And that greeter was there to help the family get through the line because, of course, the mom was pushing the child in a wheelchair with an IV line, and so she couldn't hold the tray. And so the greeter is there to hold the tray, to get the food, to bring it out to her table, and then go back and help somebody else. So it's just a it's a culture that's grown up over 54 years, and certain elements of it we're never going to change. It is really who we are.
Yeah, and it's really a thrill to hear about that culture. How many cancer patients actually does St. Jude treat each year?
So we have around 520 new cancer patients that come to St. Jude every year. You know, it's around 7,800 patients that are coming on a yearly basis through the cancer and non-cancer patients. You know, because often a cancer patient will be here for 3+ years, and then they continually come back, you know, at least once a year over the next 5 years, and then once every other year after that. So fairly large you know, cohort of patients that are coming through the campus every day, a very busy outpatient clinic. And we actually have 300 what we call domiciliary housing units, from 100 sort of short-term stay, like a hotel on campus, to a 51-unit Ronald McDonald House solely dedicated to St. Jude, to a 100 two-bedroom condominium unit that's the Target House, supported by the Target Corporation, that holds the families who are here for greater than 3 months.
And the survivorship obviously is key in multiple ways, and you offer services to survivors. So for our listeners, what's the Cancer Survivorship Research Program? How does it work?
So, you know, about 8 years ago, you know, more and more children were surviving their cancer, and nobody really knew how they were doing through the rest of their life. There was a large childhood cancer survivorship study that was being funded by the NIH, but it was a study where they were just collecting survey information. They'd send a survey to the pediatric cancer survivors, and they would self-fill it out. And, you know, we looked at that and we said, you know, we really need much, much better data. We actually need to take a cohort of childhood cancer survivors and literally follow them for the rest of their life and do medical exams on a routine basis to look at what are the complications that are developing and trace those back to which drugs, which radiation was given, and figure out how to improve on that so that they go through life, the next generation, with less and less toxicities. And for that generation that has some toxicities, how can we intervene those toxicities and make their quality of life better? So we decided we would follow 3,000 of our long-term survivors. Contacted those survivors. We asked them if they wanted to enroll in the study. And so we fly them back to campus, you know, every other or once every 3 years, do a complete medical workup on them, you know, obtain biologic samples from them, you know, from a physical exam to echocardiograms to mammography to colonoscopy, and really develop a database of where they are in their health, you know, depending on how far out they are from the treatment for their childhood cancer. And so great insights are coming out of this. We are seeing some long-term complications, and we now are able to associate those with particular therapies. We are taking those patients and developing interventional protocols to see if we can ameliorate those long-term complications. We also have decided to look at the genomics of those patients, and we've sequenced the entire genome of 3,000 of those patients. And so that data will just continue to build on it, on the data that we've already obtained, and we're going to expand the cohort to 4,500 patients. So it's the most sophisticated, most in-depth, long-term survivorship program for pediatric cancer patients. And it, for the information we're going to gain from this, is going to make their quality of life better, and it is going to change the way we treat patients in the future.
And it also allows one generation to directly benefit the next. Are they, in fact, aware of just how valuable their lives are to the next generation?
I think, you know, they are, and they they remain so committed to St. Jude, because most of these patients are coming back on weekends. You know, so they're giving up their weekends to come back. You know, we were doing a survey of them and saying, well, would you like to stay in a hotel? You know, we can put you up in a hotel. They're adults now. They can go to a hotel or to room service, you know, be relaxed. Nope, they wanted to stay on campus. They wanted to be part of the campus again and to, you know, experience the changes that have occurred and to realize that they contributed to this, that they are part of the team at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. You know, so it's an amazing group of people. You know, we have a survivorship day every year where they come back and we, you know, give lectures and workshops on how they should think about their care as they move forward. You know, so they are part of the research team. They are part of St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, and they will be for the rest of their life.
And looking forward, what does the future hold for St. Jude? What would you ideally like to see happen?
Well, I think we will become a global resource. I think, you know, we will strengthen what we do on campus. We will lead precision medicine for pediatric cancer. We will define how best to use proton therapy in the treatment of pediatric cancer patients. We will make substantial inroads in advancing the treatment of children with sickle cell disease and non-malignant hematology. I think what I also see, though, is that St. Jude will develop and fund a clinical research consortium, really working with the best institutions around the globe to develop protocols that can only be done at the most sophisticated institutions, but to, you know, fund these studies, carry these out. Because we'll work together, we'll be able to accomplish them quicker because we'll be able to enroll more patients on those protocols, and then to take that information and disseminate that so that it benefits all children with cancer, no matter where they're being treated. And then I think the other thing is our international outreach program, or what we will likely rebrand as St. Jude Global. Really a St. Jude Children's Research Hospital global alliance, where right now we're in 17 countries, 24 different programs, but to really expand around the world, to really, you know, coordinate the efforts around the globe to bring pediatric oncologists and all of the other medical specialties together, whether it be South America or Central America or the Middle East or Asia or Africa or India, and to coordinate them into collaborative groups within their region so that they can work together and they can advance cures within their region. And so we are going to significantly advance our international outreach effort. And our goal, you know, is to really make sure that every child in the world has access to quality care, which will be defined by the medical systems in those areas, but has access to quality care within 50 years, or really within 20 years if we can accomplish it quicker, and to develop an educational infrastructure at St. Jude where we train the next generation of leaders from around the world. So we'll start a new master's program and, you know, literally to have a goal that every single physician in the world that treats children with cancer at some point during their career actually has come through St. Jude Children's Research Hospital to an educational conference or to a workshop and experienced this institution and been able to gain support from this institution to advance the work they do no matter where they are in the world.
And nurturing as the next generation of leaders is obviously so key. And I would think that a lot of young people, either when they first go to college or when they graduate or when they get out of graduate school even, you know, they're at the place where they have to decide whether to choose a nonprofit career, a medical career, a business career. Do you have specific advice that you'd like to offer to young people who are actually seeking to pursue nonprofit careers?
Yeah, I think, you know, the advice I give is probably the same to, you know, no matter what they're thinking of doing. You have to find something you're passionate about. This is something that you wake up in the morning excited to go to work. You come home at night feeling satisfied that you actually did a good day's work and that you accomplished something, you know, and not worry about the level of pay you get for it or the sort of material rewards you get for it, because they don't amount to much in the end. What amounts to, you know, what really counts in the end is, you know, did you enjoy what you're doing, and is what you were doing having a benefit on mankind? And I guess the other piece of advice I always give young people is, don't worry about plan B. Focus on plan A. You know, go for it. Go for what you want to do. Give it everything you got. Don't keep thinking about the alternative. And if you fail, you got the best safety net in the world. You've got yourself. And if you're educated well, you're going to do fine. So don't cut yourself short by worrying about what am I going to do if I fail. Just go for it.
And on that note, James, we wish everyone at St. Jude all the best. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, well, thank you. Enjoyed it.
The best way to reach James and to support St. Jude is through stjude.org. Click on the webpage links above this podcast for further details.
Thank you for joining us today. Our library of interviews and a range of further resources may be found at archstreetpress.org or prx.org.